This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 168. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
020-88-167-691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. Well, welcome to the show, Garris. Welcome to the show, Berners.
Hello, Coach. How are you? You all right?
I'm good, yeah. I've got my cup of tea here, so I'm ready to go.
Hello, guys.
Someone bought me a mug for my birthday, which holds about a pint and a half of tea. So that keeps me going through the recording of these sessions very nicely.
Oh, the old mug. The old mug. The get-out-of-jail birthday present.
Yeah, it's ginormous. I can fit my whole hand in it easily. I think my youngest son could probably put his head in it.
They're always good mugs for tea, those ones.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so let's talk a little bit about cricket. Less about tea, more about cricket. And, of course, living in the UK, the Olympics is getting high on everybody's mind around here, but it's a worldwide event. And, of course, there's going to be a little bit of cricket at the opening ceremony.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the English theme, isn't it? And trying to get across the green and luscious countryside obviously includes a little bit of cricket in there as well, which will be a spectacle, not so much for us in this country, but certainly for a number of nations that are going to be partaking in the Olympics. It's good to see us getting in on it, even if there isn't a cricket competition.
I don't know how much it does for the image of a very important sort of grassroots part of the game, village cricket, now with cricket not being played in schools and things like that. It's, tea on the green with the vicar and all that kind of thing is a bit of an old-fashioned image, isn't it?
Well, it is, but also, you know, these things are cyclical, aren't they? And I think, things like the NatWest Cricket Force and all of the stuff that the ECB are doing, there's been a bit of a reconnection towards that within the villages now. And I went to something the other week where it was very, as I remember it, I suppose, growing up, really. You know, it was probably a bit stereotypical, but there's nothing wrong with that. And as much as the game's moved on in the past 10 years in particular with professionalism and T20, ultimately, we're still a very traditional sport. And in this country in particular, I still think there's some merit in sticking to some of those sort of club cricket, village cricket, very community-based values.
I've just done a bit of research, and back in 1900, Devon and Somerset Wanderers actually represented Great Britain and played against the French Athletic Club Union.
That's right.
Which mostly consisted of British Embassy staff. But I read quite an interesting piece the other day saying that they've just brought cricket into Western regions of France. So that's very interesting. Yeah, into schools, because apparently the notion of football and what it derives into the younger being's mind these days wasn't quite conceived as appropriate. So they've decided to go for cricket, which should hopefully show them a few more traditional values, I think, that they're aiming at, which is absolutely tremendous news.
Well, it's very much a growing sport in France, and I actually had an email this morning from somebody who I used to teach and coach many moons ago at the cricket school down in Dorset, who's taken on the role as the national coach of a French team, and they're going off with a very inexperienced team off to a European Championships, and he was just asking for bits and bobs of advice. But great to see that France are beginning to get their younger players coming through. I know that they've relied very much on their experienced players and quite a lot of expat players, particularly from the Asian countries. But now they're beginning to produce their own younger guys and taking them to tournaments. So no, it's very much alive and growing. And I think a lot of the work that ICC Europe are doing around the other countries. I'm off to Finland in August to do some work with their national squad for a few days. And I think the work that Richard Holdsworth, who took over from me at Cricket Ireland, and Phil Hudson have done within Europe in developing cricket has been magnificent, and it's fantastic to hear that the schools are taking it on in France.
Well, that's an interesting point, actually. I think George DeBell originally made it on Crick Info, saying that a lot of cricket beneath the sort of the top 10 or the top 12, I suppose, is never going to grow as much as perhaps we would like it to grow because funding is so difficult to get hold of. And that's where cricket at the Olympics would really help, because it would make it easier for associate and affiliate countries to get funding where at the moment there is very little available.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they tried it, didn't they? In I think it was in Kuala Lumpur, the Commonwealth Games. They had a T20 competition there, and I know all of the big countries put teams in, but also some of the smaller Commonwealth countries. And well, and the only reason it didn't work is because the wickets weren't good enough. And they played a 2020 competition before. I think this was before the 2020 revolution really hit us. Yet the pitches weren't up to scratch. But in Olympic terms, there's a big push now, and I see lots of things on Facebook and lots of things on the internet now that are pushing for a T20 tournament within a within the Olympics. And you look at the football, and now Great Britain have got a football squad in the Olympics. It would be fantastic if there was a Great Britain cricket team which had the same sort of stipulations, that maybe included some of the Scotland, some of the lads that are in Wales, some Northern Irish contingent, as well as England players, maybe an under 23s team or whatever, playing in a T20 competition. I think it would be good for player development, and it would be good for Great Britain players, but also it would be good for some of the countries that don't get that exposure into top level cricket in a format that can be relatively competitive at.
Yeah. Going on from exposure, of course, the Olympics has probably got that unique part about it, which it is the one of the only event which literally draws visibility from every single corner of the globe, doesn't it? More so than probably even a football World Cup in certain respects. So any game that you play that can potentially be watched is going to be reaping the rewards, I'd imagine.
It's probably global, isn't it? I mean, it is the global event, and it brings in everybody, as you say, because certain countries have even some of the more obscure sports are featured in the Olympics, and a number of the smaller countries actually excel in some of the less mainstream sports. So I always like the opening ceremony, not just for the stuff that we're going to see, which depicts England, but also just to see the number of countries and the smaller teams that turn up, because often those smaller teams are the teams that get bronzes or nearly in the medals in some of the less popular sports.
It would be quite funny to see someone like Korea build a 20,000 cricket stadium. The legacy options might be quite possible.
You certainly wouldn't want it in the north, would you?
I'm slightly torn about the idea of cricket in the Olympics, though, because it would be good for smaller countries and growing the game in smaller countries. But on the other hand, I see the Olympics as the pinnacle of performance. And if you have an under 23 tournament like you do with the football or something like that, it's not the peak. It's not the thing that everyone is striving towards like you get with the Olympics.
Well, it's more athletics based, isn't it? And they've just tried to creep these team games in to fluff it out a bit, I think. But yeah, you could argue that what's the point if you're going to play a half-bodged side? Then, what does it actually mean? Looking at the Great British football side, it's kind of like, right, A, who's available? B, who wants to play? C, hang on a minute, half these guys can't play because they've got to be under 23. So naturally, I think Beckham's the captain, isn't he? It's all a bit of a kind of Laurel and Hardy show just to get football in the games. So like you say, the actual credible value of the actual skill set could well be questionable. They'll probably play at a very low pace. Probably won't be very many tackles going in because they'll all be looking forward to their new season coming up. Imagine if one of them goes out with a broken leg in the Olympics for someone like Tottenham or Arsenal. Hell will break loose. So you have got that side of it, I guess.
Okay, so that's enough talking about the Olympics. Let's head to the yes-no round, the section where we only get a chance to answer yes or no to some questions which every week we probably want to give several minutes answer to. So, Berners, you've got the yes-no round questions there. Let's go for it.
Okay, first question. You should never criticise a shy at the stumps.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question. 50 over cricket is as much about taking wickets as reducing run rate.
No.
Yes.
Question 3. Fielding is always fun.
No.
Yes.
No.
Always?
It's only because you're crap at it, Berners.
Okay. Let's move on to the question section. Time now that we delve into the mailbag and read out some questions. And of course, the best question every week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. But even if you don't win the prize, if your question is read out, you get a full, comprehensive and detailed answer from Mark Garraway. And I chip in with some nonsense as well at the end. So, Berners, you've got the questions this week?
Yep. First question's in from Sareb. And this question is, a lot of people say that what separates good cricketers from great cricketers has a lot to do with the mental aspect of the game. And he's never really understood this concept. Does it mean that from the great cricketers get mentally tough by repeating skills, so it's ingrained into them, such as bowling at targets? Or does it mean they use special mental techniques such as visualisation?
I'd say that those aren't two separate things. They're all part of the same thing. The repeating skills, which is something that we go on about all the time, is definitely part of it. And the special mental techniques, that makes it sound probably a little bit more complicated than what it actually is, which is what a lot of people do naturally and other people have to learn how to do. But it's just a way of dealing with the thoughts that come into your head and how you handle those thoughts and whether you use them to your advantage or whether you are able to brush them aside quickly if you can't use them to your advantage. But the technique that you use is still going to be the same. So, I mean, I don't know what you think, Gareth, but I think it's both of those things, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's all about, we talk about robust confidence, don't we, which is a part of that mental strength. And I think one of the crucial things about building robust confidence rather than the confidence that goes, oh, I've got 100 yesterday, so I'm in good nick. I got naught, I'm not in good nick, which happens a lot. Mm. Robust confidence comes from stretching yourself in practice all the time. It's like somebody who's running a 10K race. They get robust confidence through their training being absolutely fantastic until pushing themselves beyond the capacities that they thought that they had in their body. And then they go to race time and they go there with a real belief because their training has been so good, because they've reached targets that they have never reached before. And they go out and perform PBs and world records and all of that sort of thing. And that comes off the back of a real stretch practice mentality, which is exactly what we're looking for. And to be stretched in practice, you have to be mentally tough. So when the ball's nipping around is a great example. You go into a net and the ball's nipping around. Instead of just thinking, oh, bloody hell, the ball's nipping around, I'm going to have a slog, or, oh, I can't play on this, you find a way. And it's tough, and you accept that you get inside edges behind square and you pick up two. You accept that you're going to play and miss every now and again, but you don't let that bother you, that you keep yourself in your bubble and you just keep playing. And you find that those sessions are the ones that when you go out in the middle and it starts to get a bit cheeky and everybody else is wilting under pressure, then you can stand up and be able to deal with those. So I'm a massive fan of stretch practice. Whenever it gets tough, you find a way. And if you find a way in your practice, and when that situation comes in the game where everybody else is wilting, you'll be the one that stands up. And that's what makes the great players from the good players. We talk a lot on here about differentials, having that resilience, having that bounce back ability, being able to deal with mistakes and get them out of your system so you're ready for the next ball to come along and to execute your things as best you can, to deal with distractions. You know, it's massively important that we are always practicing hard to develop those types of robust confidence banks that we can then deploy within games. The other thing that I find interesting about great players, and one of the greatest was Sir Ian Botham, obviously, who whenever he talks about sports psychology on the television, in commentary, talks, you know, says, oh, what a load of rubbish sports psychology is. But when you talk with him privately and you say, why were you a good player? He says, well, I was really confident about what I did. I used to see myself being successful all of the time. Well, they're two massively important parts of sports psychology. So, you know, I think it's hit the things that he found very natural. And this goes back to a point you made. A lot of players do actually see themselves being successful a lot of time. Well, that's a key part of sports psychology and a very natural thing that a lot of players have. And that's a real asset. You look at somebody like Ravi Bapari, who got some runs the other day. Ravi is probably one of the most talented players I've ever had the opportunity to work with. Yet, until now, he hasn't actually nailed down his mental toughness. And if he starts doing that, maybe the other day can be a cornerstone or a kicking point or a catalyst for him to move on, then I think you've got a great player there. But yet, he hasn't quite displayed that mental toughness, that robust confidence to go out there and perform consistently on the world stage.
You make a point about sports psychology there, Garrison. I think that generally the reputation of that word, sports psychology, is very low in cricket terms, because people think about the word techniques and, you know, sitting on a lying on a couch and doing stuff which is not related to cricket, and, you know, it's all mumbo jumbo and all that kind of thing. But what sports psychology really is, as you say, it's those extremely practical things that you do when you think, and everybody thinks. It's just how you manage the way that you think, and you have to understand yourself, because everyone is slightly different in the way that they think, and then you have to have a way of handling that. And somebody like Botham just naturally had this extremely high confidence and believed in himself, and so he didn't need sports psychology techniques, which is probably why he says, oh, it's a load of rubbish.
Yeah, he had natural strategies as opposed to ones where some of us have to learn them. And, you know, and I'll be brutally honest and say I had to learn a number of strategies as a player, and I've had to learn a number of strategies as a coach to maximise or try and get somewhere near maximising my ability as a coach, whereas Beefy had those things, you know, in abundance through without having to think about them. You know, you don't always get Ian Botham's in terms of confidence. You know, Shane Warne's of this world only come along every now and again. You know, most players do need to work at these aspects. And as you say, it's not about lying on a couch. It's not about being in a dark room. It's about doing simple things. Like Ricky Ponting says, before he goes to bed every night, he thinks about, he's got 10 questions that he asks himself. And if he can answer those 10 questions positively, he knows he's in great shape to play a great game of cricket in the next couple of days.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of, you get to the point where there's this story, and I can't remember who the cricketer was who was involved in it, but he always had chewing gum when he went out to bat, and he got out for a low score and came back and sat down, and the first thing he said was, well, this 12th man gave me the wrong flavour chewing gum, no wonder I got out. I think that's quite a good example of being able to put whatever went wrong aside and go, okay, well, you know, I'm still a good player. It just happened to be that someone gave me the wrong flavour chewing gum. So, you know, if you can do that, if you can naturally do that, you're probably not even listening to this podcast.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, that was very Beefy like that, because, you know, he always, and I don't think, you know, one of the things that you need to understand when somebody is like that, and Beefy was a classic example, having talked to two or three of his ex-teammates, it was never his fault when he got out. And that's great if that's his mechanism for dealing with failure, to sort of put a protective barrier around his confidence levels, which is what he's doing there. The challenge is that if you do that in a very extrovert way, it pees everybody else off in the changing room. And also, it might, you know, if he comes in and says, oh, the wicket's unplayable, obviously the next three batters that go in and be thinking, hang on a minute, you know, Ian Botham saying that the wicket's unplayable, so what chance have I got? So you have to manage that type of approach. And I would say that it's fairly individual strategy, that one. Team, to understand, we had a player at Hampshire who was exactly the same as that. It was never his fault, and yet he would distract people. And what we did was, instead of trying to change the player's approach to the way that he went about it, because it actually worked for him, we gave the people around him the understanding of the reasons why he was doing it, to try and prevent that from distracting them and from undermining their own confidence. So ideally, you want people to be able to attribute success and failure to themselves, because that's controllable. All right, so Andy Flower is a great example. They go out to Pakistan and lose in the test series out in Pakistan. And the first thing he does on camera is say, yeah, I've got to look at myself. I've got to get myself right. And that's good attribution, all right, because he's in control of that. So I'm going to get the programming right next time we go into a competition, and then he goes away and he's in control, and that's good attribution. The Ian Botham, the chewing gum example, I think are poor attribution. However, if that secures a player's robust self-confidence and you can educate the people around him to understand why that person is doing it, then also that can work. But that does take a lot of work from a coach.
Yeah, and it's as you rightly point out, it's very individualised.
Yeah.
So, is someone going past on a skateboard?
There's somebody going past with a cricket bag. Mate, it's authentic here. When we do this, suitable. It's authentic. We're playing Eton today, so we've got Eton coming down. We won the quarter final of the Nationals yesterday, so we've got the finals on Thursday, and we've got Eton today in an all day match. So all the lads are beginning to rumble in from registering themselves at school this morning. So yeah, all good.
Oh well, okay. Well, we better get on with the podcast then. Berners, what's the next question?
All these guys are wheelie bags. Put it over your shoulder, man. Next question's from Varun. He's an opening batsman in the subcontinent. When it comes to the old ball over there, it becomes pretty much difficult to pick in terms of the cutters and the lateral movement off the seam. Usually the ball gets pretty old just after a few overs, so it becomes pretty difficult pretty early. And as a result of this, he tends to be nicking off in the middle overs and missing out on big scores. How can we help, guys? He needs to go on and build that innings.
Yeah, so the ball's getting dirty over in the subcontinent, and as a result, he's not picking cutters, and it's the cutters that he's nicking off. Is that right? Is that what he's trying to say?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's two things there. Yes, the ball does get dirty over in the subcontinent, and therefore the seam tends to blend in with the leather parts of the ball. And that's one of the reasons why Murali's record in the subcontinent is so good, because particularly in red ball cricket, the ball would mess up quite quickly. And then you wouldn't be able to pick any seam rotations or scrambled seam rotations that he'd be bowling. So you couldn't pick it as it was going through the air, through the way that the seam was moving around. So, yeah, I get that. My question is, having watched a number of bowlers bowl in the subcontinent, is how many cutters are these guys bowling? So if you're attributing your dismissal and why you're nicking it to cutters, then you're obviously playing against some very sophisticated bowlers every week. Or is there something more technical that you're doing, which means that you're not falling onto the line of the ball properly? Because I always say to the kids here, I reckon I was gotten out about five times in my career with balls that I couldn't do anything about, and the rest of the time I found a way of getting myself out. And it sounds to me that there's a bit of attribution, going back to a previous question, that he's getting absolutely great balls every week. And I would look within before I look at those sorts of things to see if there's anything that I can be doing to stop myself from nicking the ball off. Am I falling onto the line of a ball? Am I waiting for the ball to come to me long enough? Am I pushing out at the ball if it is moving laterally instead of holding the line of a bat that we see the likes of Marcus Trescothick and Andrew Strauss and Alistair Cook do so well, where they play inside the line of a ball when it goes across them rather than pushing their hands out to the ball, which a lot of us did when we were playing. So I would look within first before I'd look at what the person at the other end's doing to get me out, because ultimately we get ourselves out a lot more than the bowler gets out. And I would suggest that they're not necessarily bowling as many cutters as you think that they might be, because if they're doing that at your level, then I'm surprised that they're not doing it. The Indian bowlers are doing it at higher levels, because I'm not seeing that those types of skills being shown on the international stage from Indian bowlers. So it's probably not the answer you're looking for, because you're probably looking for me to give you the holy grail. But I think you need to look more internally rather than externally for the reasons why you're nicking those.
Goes back into question one quite nicely, doesn't it?
I think it does, actually, to be honest. I think it does.
I think that's often a problem with not necessarily lower level, but certainly amateur players, is that whole perception of how they interpret what's going on. You know, that was really interesting earlier on, going back to the changing room. You're setting the tone for those other nine blokes who are going to go out there and bat. And likewise, if this guy is saying, well, it's because the ball's dirty, well, no, it's not. You're you're not playing down the right line, or you're, you know, your hands aren't coming through straight or whatever. So it's, and often the player's always going to take his side in terms of how he perceives it and probably take that easier option. Oh, someone else's fault, someone else is doing something.
Well, we used to have a class in, and the player will remain nameless, but there was an England player who would, when he got out, would always sort of walk around the support staff saying, oh, that was a good ball, that was a good ball, that was a good ball. And he'd come and sit next to me, and I used to think that was a limiting belief. You know, you should get good balls. I mean, that, you know, good balls are part of Test cricket. You're playing at the top level that is on this planet. You know, the bowler is going to be able to get the ball in the right place often enough. So he used to come and sit next to me and say, oh, that was a good ball, wasn't it? I used to say no, and then that person's name. That person's bowling exactly in the areas that if I were a opposition analyst, I would be asking that bowler to bowl to you. And your job is to find a way of counteracting that, because every team has got one of me and every team have got world-class bowlers that can execute plans. So it's your job to find a way of counteracting that particular ball, which you always come in and say, oh, it was a good ball, as if that's okay to get out to a good ball.
He was the bowler was doing what it says on the tin, and the batsman reading the instructions.
Yeah, absolutely right. You know, the bowler's doing his job, and your job is to counteract. And there was a great piece that was written on our website, actually, after one of my first articles. And it was a guy from America, and I think he said that in baseball, it's the pitcher's job to deceive the batter, and it's the batter's job to read the bowler or pitcher, which I thought was a great. And to be able to counteract that. And I thought that was a really lovely, simple way of looking at it, yet actually transferable across into our sport. And that's what makes it so fantastic to me, is that the bowler's doing his job. And ultimately, if you're going to play to the best of your ability, it's up to you to concentrate your skills to be able to counteract what that person is throwing at you, bowling at you. And particular player at the time and was very much, oh, that's a good ball, that's a good ball. But ultimately, it wasn't about what the person at the other end was doing. How are you going to counteract that? Because everybody knows that you are vulnerable there. So what are you going to do to counteract that? Because it's an easy ball to bowl to get it into that area.
I suppose it's a way of, as we were talking about before, it's a way of being able to put it aside and go, okay, you know, I'm still a good player. Just because I got out for a low score doesn't make me a bad player. But then on the other hand, it doesn't give you a free pass to say, I'm not going to do any more work on trying to deal with that. So it's 50-50, or six of one, half dozen of the other, really, isn't it? You don't want to use it as an excuse, but you do want to use it to be able to put that out of your mind and move on. Every week, one of the members of the team gets a chance to rant and rave about something that they really want to talk about for 1 minute without being interrupted by any other member of the team. So, Berners, this week, what have you got to say for yourself?
Well, this week, it's all about A, this activity prolongs the game, B, it's highly frustrating, and C, it can actually lose you a game, and that's the dreaded no ball. Now, it staggers to belief. Beyond belief how these guys manage to run in ball after ball, game after game. Certain players are renowned for bowling no balls, and I really don't know how hard it is. I mean, you often hear them moaning about conditions, you know, the approach to the crease or just the whole kind of conditions they're put under. But I mean, at the end of the day, the fact remains the same. You run in, you deliver the ball. If you've got to, you know, change that or adapt to the situation or the conditions, then so be it. Practice it in the nets. So many guys running off of 18 meters in the nets. How can that ever help you? So practice, you know, religiously your run up. Know what you're trying to do. And also the whole concept of moaning and, you know, belittling, you know, where you are. You're running up a hill or there's a bit of dirt there. What a load of tosh. Get your plods in the right place. Save a ball every over. You know, you don't have to work so hard and you don't give a runaway. These bowlers, they give a runaway every time they bowl. And as for spinners bowling no balls, that's a whole chapter on its own, because God only knows how a spinner could ever bowl a no ball. I just can't believe it, that someone of bowling a delivery such as a spin delivery can bowl and get their feet in such a muddle. But unbelievable. Wastes my time, certainly down at fine leg, because I've got to prolong my activity in the field, which I hate. So get your feet in the block and get on with it.
Berners, that's the longest minute I've ever listened to.
Sorry.
Thank you. that's just about all we've got time for this week on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. But before we go, a couple of little things that we need to sort out. First of all, we need a competition winner. Of course, the best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of all of us at Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Gareth, we have two questions, one from Soreb about mental toughness and one from Baron about picking cutters. Which one did you prefer?
Well, I think they were both good questions and actually overlapped into one another once we got into discussion. But I'm going to go with Baron this week. Not so much for his question, but I think the combination of the two questions, which got us into defining that you should always look at yourself first before worrying about what's happening at the other end. If you get yourself right, you give yourself the best chance of success. So Baron wins it this week.
Yes, I like those questions that promote this. Promote a discussion, even if the answer to the question is quite simple. It's nice to have a discussion. So well done, Baron. If you want to send in your own question, you can do so in the normal ways. And Berners, you've got the contact details there.
Give us a quick call. The number here is 02088 167 691, or drop us an email, and the address for that is coach@pitchvision.com.
Our Twitter is PVCricketCoach. You can find us on Facebook under facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. You can subscribe to the show if you want to listen to us every week and get the high quality advice that we provide. If you head over to iTunes, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, you can find us in there. And if you don't want to use iTunes, go to pitchvision.com, click on the podcast link, and all the details for subscribing in any kind of subscription service you want are available. It's completely free for all time. So just we need to finish off with the tail ender, and this week I was reading an old book on captaincy by Graham Gooch, which is called Captaincy, and he was talking about a fielding position which is on the perch, which I haven't heard for some time, but it's that position which is kind of mid wicket level with the stumps, which is used in one day cricket so effectively nowadays. So have you ever used that term, Gareth, on the perch?
I haven't. I mean, yeah, we call it being in the box either side of the box. So yeah, but yeah, that's, I like that, on the perch. Yeah, why not? Gooch comes out with good stuff, so I like that. I might use that.
Yeah, it is kind of on the perch, isn't it? You're sort of perched on the edge of the square, and you know, it's a good way of thinking that you're poised and ready for action.
Yeah, definitely. No, I like that. I like that a lot.
You good on the perch, Berners? Diving around.
I don't know about. I like it, but I wouldn't say I am, no.
I'll tell you who was good on the perch. Bill Athley. Bill Athley was phenomenal on the perch when he was in the England setup in the sort of mid 1980s. I remember him being magnificent during the famous England tour to Australia where they won everything. Taking loads of catches on the perch, diving left, right and centre and getting run outs, did a magnificent job, made that position a really important one within one day cricket in the same way as Jonty Rhodes a few years later made backward point a really important position.
It does look good when you're throwing yourself around.
Arkell must have been good on the perch.
Arkell would have been good on the perch, yeah, definitely.
And everyone's good on the perch these days. I don't think anyone can get away with it, even the fast
Correct.
bowlers.
I'm perched on my bar stool after the game's complete.
So that's all for this week. Until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Berners.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, coach.